Ayrım 13.
Sayfa 150. Intellectually, first deists and then skeptics question the possibility of miracles, the truth of the historical narratives in which Christianity is alleged to rest, the traditional proofs of the existence of God, and the intolerance of ecclesiastical morality. Socially, what was a religious morality becomes increasingly a religious form and frame, disguising or merely decorating purely secular ideals and pursuits. As a matter of history, the culmination of this process in the 18th century is a victory for the morality whose ancestry includes Hobbes and the Sophists. In both England and New England in the 17th and 18th centuries, Puritanism is transformed from a critic of the established order in the name of King Jesus to an endorsement of the new economic activities of the middle classes. At the end of this process, economic man emerges fully fledged. Throughout, human nature appears as given, and human need or what is useful to supply it as a single, uncomplicated standard for action. Utility and advantage are treated as clear and perspicuous notions, which stand in no further need of justification. We can see this process most clearly exemplified in the writings of Defoe, who was unusually self-aware and unusually aware, too, of the nature of the times. He sees that Christianity of the Commonwealth period has evaporated. No such zeal for the Christian religion will be found in our days, or perhaps in any region of the world, till heaven beats the drums itself, and the glorious legions from above come down on purpose to propagate the work and reduce the whole world to the obedience of King Jesus, a time which some tell us is not far off, but of which I heard nothing in all my travels and illuminations, no, not one word. Footnote: Serious Reflections of Robinson Crusoe, page 325. This view of Defoe I owe, of course, to the analysis of Professor Ian Watts in The Rise of the Novel, a book whose interest for the student of morality can scarcely be overrated. Moreover, all Defoe's heroes are moved by the values of double entry, bookkeeping, and human feelings are allowed to enter only into the interstices left by profitability. As Moll Flanders puts it, with money in the pocket, one is at home anywhere. The little Moor, without whom Crusoe could not have escaped from slavery and whom Crusoe had decided to love ever after, is sold into slavery himself by Crusoe for 60 pieces of 8, admittedly with a promise from the purchaser to free the slave after 10 years. Provided, of course, that he has been converted to Christianity. The wives of the colonists in the farther adventures of Robinson Crusoe are assessed wholly in economic terms. Of Defoe's characters, it is often true that enjoyment is subordinate to capital, and the individual who enjoys to the individual who capitalizes. Marx, who wrote this about capitalist human nature, would have appreciated Defoe's conclusion that usefulness is the great pleasure and justly deemed by all good men the truest and noblest end of life, in which men come nearest to the character of our bee savior who went about doing good. But the assertion of economic values and the absorption of religious values into them is only one side of the story. I have already noticed the increasing importance in the preceding period of the concept of the individual. The individual is now on the scene with a vengeance. Robinson Crusoe becomes the Bible of a generation which includes both Rousseau and Adam Smith. The novel, with its stress on individual experience and its value, is about to emerge as the dominant literary form. Social life becomes essentially an arena for the struggles and conflicts of individual wills. The first ancestor of all these individuals is perhaps Milton Satan, who brought Blake over to the Devil's Party and has been seen as the first Whig. For Satan's motto, non serviam, marks not merely a personal revolt against God, but a revolt against the concept of an ordained and unchangeable hierarchy. The complexity and interest of Satan lies in the fact that he both has to and cannot reject this hierarchy. The only alternative to service is monarchy. But monarchy implies the hierarchy which revolt rejects. Equally, Satan's spiritual descendant, Tom Jones, is caught in the same dilemma. Tom Jones wins his Sophia in the end because a mixture of personal quality and sheer good luck enable him to make his way. But at the end, if he is in fact to have his Sophia, it has to be shown that he is really of good birth, that he too really belongs by right to the squirearchy. The values of the traditional social hierarchy are only half challenged. We thus find a form of social life in which a traditional order is challenged by forms of innovation in which liberty and property are twin sides of the same coin. To make one's way is to make one's way economically, at least in the first instance. But the badge of success remains acceptance by those already on top in the established order of things. Yet this very mobility in society and this very encounter of two orders breeds questioning of a radical kind. Perhaps the utopian claims for freedom made by the diggers and levelers had declined into the freedom of the Puritan and ever less Puritan merchant. But they remain a specter to haunt the 18th century. Hume is appalled by the suggestion of a law which apportions property to those best able to make use of it or to men as men. But were mankind to execute such a law, so great is the uncertainty of merit, both from its natural obscurity and from the self-conceit of each individual, that no determinate rule of conduct would ever result from it, and the total dissolution of society must be the immediate consequence. Fanatics may suppose that dominion is founded on grace and that saints alone inherit the earth. But the civil magistrate very justly puts these sublime theorists on the same footing with common robbers and teaches them by the severest discipline that a rule which in speculation may seem the most advantageous to society may yet be found in practice totally pernicious and destructive. That there were religious fanatics of this kind in England who claimed an equal distribution of property were a kind of political fanatic which arose from the religious species and more openly answered their pretensions. Footnote: Inquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals, Section 3, Part 2. Who then were the levelers and the diggers? And why do they mark a turning point in the history of morality and produce consequences for philosophical ethics? What is the doctrine of freedom that in the early 18th century was temporarily lost or transformed? It is the doctrine that every man has a natural right to certain freedoms simply because he is a man. Diggers and levelers give different interpretations to this doctrine at the economic level. The diggers believed in a community of goods and especially in common ownership of land, the levelers in private property. The levelers themselves at different times gave different and inconsistent expressions to this belief at a political level. Sometimes they claimed universal manhood suffrage, and sometimes they were prepared to exclude servants and beggars, who in the 17th century were probably more than half the male population of England. But always behind their specific claims was the doctrine expressed by Colonel Thomas Rainborough in the Putney debates. For really I think that the poorest he that is in England hath a life to live as the greatest he. And therefore, truly, sir, I think it's clear that every man that is to live under a government ought first by his own consent to put himself under that government. Footnote: Putney debates in Puritanism and Liberty being the army debates, 1647-8, from the Clark manuscripts, selected and edited by A.S.P. Woodhouse. Rainborough said this in a debate between the representatives of the leveler rank and file in the Cromwellian army and Cromwell, Ireton, and other leading officers on Putney Heath in October 1647. The debate was over the political stand that the army should take in settling affairs after the king's defeat. Ireton and Cromwell wished for a restricted property franchise. To this, the reply of Rainborough and others was that in that case the poor men who fought in the parliamentary army were to get nothing for their pains. Instead of exchanging tyranny for liberty, they would have exchanged tyranny for tyranny. But had they known this in advance, they would never have fought. The case that Rainborough advanced at Putney in 1647 had a year earlier been expressed in theoretical terms by Richard Overton in his An Arrow Against All Tyrants. To every individual in nature is given an individual property by nature, not to be invaded or usurped by any. For every one, as he is himself, so he hath a self a property, else could he not be himself, and on this no second may presume to deprive any of, without manifest violation and affront to the very principles of nature, and of the rules of equity and justice between man and man, mine and thine cannot be except this be. No man hath power over my rights and liberties, and I over no man's. I may be but an individual, enjoy myself and myself a property, and may right myself no more than myself, or presume any further. If I do, I am an encroacher and an invader upon another man's right, to which I have no right. Footnote: An Arrow Against All Tyrants, page 3. So came the doctrine of natural rights in its revolutionary form into the modern world. Overton's nature is very different from Hobbes. The principles of nature as much constrain me from invading the domain of others as they entitle me to resist others who invade my domain. What is my domain? Myself, myself a property. The latter word is the immediate ancestor of, but not the same word as, property. Overton understood, as Locke was to understand, that I am only able to act as a person in so far as I have a minimal control over things. My knife or my hammer or my pen may not be quite as necessary to me as my hand is, but are necessary in a comparable kind of way. But now what entitles this self to rights? The attack upon the concept of natural rights normally takes the following form. A right can only be claimed or exercised in virtue of a rule which entitles a certain class of people to claim or exercise the right. Such rules are intelligible when embodied in some system of positive law enacted by a sovereign legislator. But outside ordinary positive law, the notion of a right appears only to make sense if we suppose a divine lawgiver who has enacted a system of law for the universe. Yet the claim that there are natural rights does not rest on an appeal to divine law, and it does not rest, ex hypothesi, it cannot rest, on any appeal to positive law. For the particular legal system does not concede to some individual or class within the community the rights to which he or they are entitled. So it is argued, alleged, natural rights do not satisfy the minimal condition necessary for a right to exist and to be recognized. Critics of this kind, therefore, conclude either that the doctrine of natural right is inherently confused, or that it is just is a way of expressing a moral principle that all men ought to have certain rights recognized and protected by positive law and its sanctions. The latter alternative is certainly mistaken, for when men appeal to the doctrine of natural rights, they are never just saying that they ought to enjoy certain rights, they are always attempting to give a reason for holding this. So if this line of criticism is correct, it appears that we ought to conclude that the claim to natural rights is nonsensical. But is it? If another claims something from me and does not or cannot invoke positive law to justify his claim, then I can ask him in virtue of what it is that he makes this claim. He might provide such a sufficient justification for his claim if he could establish, first, that I had explicitly or tacitly conceded his right by agreeing to some contract or promise of the form, if you do this, then I will do that, and if he could establish, second, that he had done for his part whatever it was that the contract specified. That is, anyone who wishes to establish that he has a claim against me, as of right may do, this is, if he is able to show that I have acknowledged a certain contractual obligation and that he has performed whatever is laid down by the contract in question. From this general argument, we can now move once more to the doctrine of natural rights. The essence of the claim to natural rights is that no one has a right against me unless he can cite some contract, my consent to it, and his performance of his obligations under it. To say that I have a right on some point is simply to say that no one may legitimately interfere with me unless he can establish a specific right against me in this way. Thus, the function of the doctrine of natural right is to lay down conditions to which anyone who wishes to establish a right against me must conform. And anyone here includes the state. It follows that any state which claims rights against me, that is, legitimate authority over me and my property, must establish the existence of a contract whose form we have already specified in outline, my consent to it, and the state's performance of its part under the contract. This apparently trivial conclusion throws much light on 17th century and later political theory. It explains why the social contract is necessary for anyone who wishes to defend the legitimacy of state power. Hobbes misplaced the role of the contract. It does not and cannot underlie or explain social life as such, for contracts presuppose, as I have already argued, the existence of social life and indeed of some fairly high degree of civilization. But some doctrine of social contract must underlie any claim to legitimacy. In the 17th century, this claim becomes crucial for state power. In the Middle Ages, the legitimacy of the final authority, the sovereign prince, was bound up with all the other ties of obligation and duty binding superiors and inferiors. These ties are by the 17th century fatally loosened. Man and man confront one another in an arena where the cash nexus of the free market economy and the power of the centralizing state have together helped to destroy the social bonds on which traditional claims to legitimacy were founded. But how to legitimate the new order and especially the sovereign power? Claims to divine right and scriptural authority founder on arbitrariness. So the state must fall back on appeal, implicit or explicit, to social contract. But at once two points. The very claims of the state imply and allow a prepolitical, and such is the force of natural, right of the individual over whom authority is asserted to be satisfied that there is a contract, that he has consented to it, and that the state has performed its part. But of course, normally there is no such contract, for there is no such consent. Individuals have no opportunity for expression of either consent or dissent. Thus, the doctrine of natural rights is in this form a key doctrine of liberty, for it shows that most claims of most states to exercise legitimate authority over us are and must be unfounded. That radical consequences for both morals and politics ensue are obvious. It is thus the case that a great step forward in moral and political philosophy was taken by half-forgotten thinkers like Rainborough, Winstanley, the Digger, and Overton, and other levelers. That they are forgotten is due to the various ways their doctrine was transmuted in the following generations. Morally, as I have already noticed, the rights of the individual were increasingly connected with the right of freedom in the market economy. Politically, the doctrine of John Locke displaced theirs. But because Locke's doctrine is as important for morals as for politics, to it we must now turn. Chapter 12. The British 18th Century Argument. John Locke's Two Treatises of Government was published in England in 1690 with the avowed motive of justifying the Whig Rebellion and Revolution of 1688, which had put William of Orange on the English throne. Locke wished to defend the new regime by showing that rebellion by Williamites against King James had been legitimate, but that rebellion by Jacobites against King William in 1689 and after would be illegitimate. Thus, Locke poses once more the Hobbesian questions: in what does the legitimate authority of a sovereign consist, and when, if ever, is rebellion justified? Like Hobbes, Locke begins from a portrait of the state of nature. But the Lockean state of nature is not in fact pre-social nor pre-moral. Men in it live in families in a settled social order. They have and enjoy property. They make and acknowledge claims upon one another. But their life has defects. Every rational creature is aware of the law of nature. But the bias of interest and lack of attention cause men to apply it more rigorously in the case of others than of themselves, while crimes that are committed may well go unpunished for lack of a proper authority. Disputes between men have no impartial arbiter to decide them, and every dispute will therefore tend toward a state of war between the parties. All these considerations make desirable the handing over of authority to a civil power in whom trust can be reposed. So the contract. The aim of the contract is to create an authority adequate to safeguard our natural rights, and for Locke the most important of rights is that of property. Locke begins from a position not too dissimilar from that of Overton. A man's person and his property are so closely linked that his natural right to liberty must extend from one to the other. To what property am I entitled? To that which my labor has created. A man may acquire as much property as his labor enables him to make use of. We must remember at this point that what is being spoken of is a man's rights in a state of nature prior to the laws of civil society. Locke supposes a state of affairs where land is unlimited and transfer of property not yet instituted. Can such a state of things exist? In the beginning, all the world was America, and more so than it is now, for no such thing as money was anywhere known. Footnote: Second Treatise of Civil Government, Section 5. What is the effect of the contract? Men hand over to a legislative and executive power the authority to pass and to enforce laws which will protect their natural rights. In so doing, they both transfer that authority and set limits to it. For in so far as the civil authority does not protect natural rights, it ceases to be a legitimate authority. The guarantee that it will protect such rights lies in the provision that the only valid laws are those passed by a majority vote. In this aspect of his thought, Locke is the ancestor of liberal democracy. But with just this aspect of his thought, a difficulty arises. The laws are designed for the protection of property. Who are the possessors of property? Although Locke believed that a man could not alienate away from himself the right to liberty for his person, the legal expression of which includes such measures as habeas corpus, he does allow that property is alienable. A man's initial right is only to such property as his labor has created, but with the wealth derived therefrom, he may acquire the property of others and he may acquire servants. If he does, their labor creates property for him. Therefore, gross inequality in property is consistent with Locke's doctrine of a natural right to property. Not only this, but Locke seems to have been aware of the fact that more than half the population of England was effectively propertyless. How then is he able to reconcile his view of the right of the majority to rule with his view of the natural right to property? Is he not involved in the difficulty which has been alleged against the levelers? That if the kind of franchise which they advocated had been brought in, the majority of the voters would in fact have chosen to abolish even such civil and religious liberty as existed under the Parliament and under Cromwell, and would have voted to restore the monarchy. So against Locke, might it not be argued that to give the rule to the majority will be to give the rule to the many whose interest lies in the abolition of the right of the few to the property which they have acquired? This problem is raised nowhere explicitly in Locke, and the reason may be that Locke takes it for granted that the answer to this question is no, and he is able to take this for granted because he is able to assume that what the majority do and will accept is an oligarchical government controlled by the property owners, and especially by the owners of large-scale property. Why is he able to assume this? Perhaps because of his doctrine of tacit consent. Locke writes that every man that hath any possession or enjoyment of any part of the dominions of any government doth thereby give his tacit consent and is as far forth obliged to obedience to the laws of that government during such enjoyment as any one under it, whether this his possession be of land to him and his heirs forever, or a lodging only for a week, or whether it be barely traveling freely on the highway, and in effect it reaches as far as the very being of anyone within the territories of that government. Footnote. Second Treatise of Civil Government, Section 119. Thus it follows that the wandering gypsy on the road has consented to the authority of the government, which may therefore legitimately conscript him into its armed forces. Locke's doctrine is important because it is the doctrine of every modern state which claims to be democratic, but which, like every state, wishes to coerce its citizens. Even if the citizens are not consulted and have no means of expressing their views on a given topic, they are held to have tacitly consented to the actions of governments. Moreover, we can see why modern democratic states have no alternative but to fall back upon a doctrine of this kind. For, like Locke's Whig oligarchy, they have nothing to ground their legitimacy upon but popular consent. And, as in Locke's Whig oligarchy, the majority of their subjects have no genuine opportunity to participate in the political process except in the most passive way. It follows that either the authority claimed by the government of these states is not genuine, and that their subjects are therefore under no obligation to obey them, or that they are legitimated by some kind of tacit consent on the part of the subjects. But for the latter alternative to hold, the doctrine of tacit consent must, of course, be meaningful. Unfortunately, for the state it is not. For the minimum conditions for the word consent to have meaningful application include at least that the man alleged to have consented shall somehow have signified his consent, and that he shall have sometime indicated his understanding of what he has consented to. But neither of these conditions is satisfied by the doctrine of tacit consent. Locke's own doctrine also stands or falls with his particular version of the argument that natural rights derive from a moral law which we apprehend by reason. In the essay concerning human understanding, he argues that although our moral ideas derive from sense experience, the relations between these ideas are such that morality is capable of demonstration as well as mathematics. The propositions of morals can be apprehended as certain truths merely by a scrutiny of the terms which they contain and the ideas expressed by these terms. What are the key moral terms? Good is that which causes pleasure or diminishes pain. Evil, that which causes pain or diminishes pleasure. Moral good is the conformity of our actions to a law, the sanctions of which are rewards of pleasure and punishments of pain. There are three kinds of law: divine, civil, and those conventions established tacitly with a quite different criterion of consent from that involved in the treatise, for now consent to the law of opinion or reputation is signified by active approval of what the law enjoins or prohibits. In this view of moral judgments as founded upon the rational scrutiny of moral concepts, Locke has both English predecessors and English successors. What is distinctive in Locke is the way in which good and evil are defined in terms of pleasure and pain without the abandonment of this semi-Platonic view of moral concepts. The reference to Plato is important. The view of moral judgments as resembling mathematical is found in Locke's immediate predecessors, the Cambridge Platonists, a group of Anglican metaphysicians and moralists who included Benjamin Whitcourt and Henry Moore. Moore had argued in his Enchiridion Ethicum, 1668, that the 23 fundamental moral principles which he enumerates are self-evident moral truths. If we look at them, we shall perhaps be tempted to conclude that the resemblance between moral truths and mathematical consists in the fact that the alleged moral truths turn out to be mere tautologies, at best definitions of the key moral terms, rather than judgments which make use of them. The first of Moore's truths, for example, is that good is that which is pleasing, agreeable, and fitting to some perceptive life, or to a degree of this life, and which is conjoined with the conservation of the percipient, which is clearly intended as a definition. But those English philosophers from the Cambridge Platonists onward, who held that moral distinctions are derived from reason in a manner similar to that in which mathematical distinctions are derived, cannot be adequately characterized solely in terms of a confusion between the role of definitions and that of substantial moral judgments. Of this confusion, they were certainly often guilty, but they combined with it a much more plausible contention, whose authentic ancestor is indeed Plato. This is the doctrine that it is a condition of having grasped a moral concept that one should have grasped the criteria for its correct application, and that these criteria are unambiguous and sufficient to determine the truth of any moral judgment. Of this doctrine, two things must be said. The first is that it makes moral judgments resemble empirical judgments as much as it makes them resemble mathematical. If I have grasped the concepts expressed by the word red, then I have grasped the criteria for correctly calling some object red. This point the Cambridge Platonists themselves might have made, for they were equally anxious to stress the a priori element in empirical knowledge. The second remark worth making is that, if this view is correct, then of two men who judge differently on a moral question, it must always be the case that one at least must simply have failed to grasp the relevant concept, and so have failed to use the relevant moral expression correctly. But this appears certainly to be a mistake. Any adequate account of moral concepts must include some more plausible account of moral disagreement than this. This was not, however, the ground on which the ethical rationalists were attacked by their contemporaries. Anthony Ashley, the Earl of Shaftesbury and Locke's pupil, argued that it is not by reason, but by a moral sense, that moral distinctions are made. No sooner are actions viewed, no sooner the human affections and passions discerned, and they are most of them as soon discerned as felt, than straight an inward eye distinguishes and sees the fair and shapely, the amiable and admirable, apart from the deformed, the foul, the odious, or the despicable. How is it possible, therefore, not to own that as these distinctions have their foundation in nature, the discernment itself is natural and from nature alone? Footnote: Characteristics of Man, Manners, Opinions, Times, 1773 edition, 2, 415. A moral judgment is thus the expression of a response of feeling to some property of an action, just as, on Shaftesbury's view, an aesthetic judgment is the expression of just such a response to the properties of shapes and figures. But what are the properties of the actions which evoke a favorable rather than an unfavorable response? The virtuous man is he who had harmonized his own inclinations and affections in a way that renders them also harmonious with the inclinations and affections of his fellow creatures. Harmony is the great moral property. Between what will satisfy me and what will be for the good of others, there is no conflict. Man's natural bent is toward benevolence. This appears to Shaftesbury to be a simple matter of contingent fact. It is as a simple matter of contingent fact that Bernard de Mandeville questions it. In the grumbling hive, or knaves turned honest, and in the fable of the bees, or private vices, public benefits, Mandeville attacks Shaftesbury's two central propositions. That man's natural bent is to act in an altruistic way, and that it is altruism and benevolence that procure social benefit. In fact, argues Mandeville, the spring of action is private and egoistical self-interest, and the public good of society is the outcome of the private individual's disregard for any good but his own. It is a happy accident that the pursuit of enjoyment and luxury promotes economic enterprise, and that the promotion of economic enterprise raises the level of general prosperity. Were men, in fact, virtuous in the way that Shaftesbury supposes, social life would never advance at all. The notion that private virtue is a public good is derived from the claims to private virtue made by those who wish to disguise their self-seeking behind moral professions in order to aggrandize themselves more successfully. Mandeville thus raises the second great issue for English moral philosophy in the 18th century. If moral judgments are expressions of feeling, how can they be more than expressions of self-interest? If moral action is grounded in feeling, what feelings provide the springs of benevolence? From Mandeville onward, philosophers divide not only upon the issue of the moral sense versus reason, but also, although sometimes implicitly rather than explicitly, on the correct way to answer Mandeville. The greatest of the moral sense theorists between Shaftesbury and Hume, Francis Hutcheson, simply evaded the issue. The moral sense is one which perceives those properties which arouse responses of moral feeling. There is also an aesthetic sense which stands to beauty as the moral sense does to virtue. The properties which arouse a pleasurable and approving response are those of benevolence. What we approve are not actions in themselves, but actions as manifestations of traits of character, and our approval seems to consist simply in the arousal of the required response. But why do we approve of benevolence rather than of self-interest? Hutcheson has no answer to this question. He merely asserts that we do. Equally, when he treats of benevolence as the whole of virtue, he rests his view on mere assertion. It is noteworthy that in his account of choice, Hutcheson never puts himself in the place of the agent. He speaks, and anyone who held his views would have had to speak, as a purely external observer.